little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics. And my name is Bob Frelick, and I'm here with the other host of Thinking Clearly, Julia Minton.
Hey, that's Julia. Me.
That's you.
I'm the other host.
Yes, you are. And, you know, as we usually do, we love to get feedback from our listeners. And so, Julia, why don't you tell them how they can get their thoughts to us and suggestions for future guests and stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as I like to say, Bob and I are real people. You can find us on Facebook with the real and not real people that occupy Facebook. You just simply search Thinking Clearly Radio. It should come right up where promos for our shows are posted, as well as show notes. And you can converse and comment with us. And, oh, the podcast. How could I forget? A little light went on above my head. How about that?
Literally did, yes.
Yeah, so, you know, what I do is I open up my favorite podcast app, because there's a lot of them out there. Search Thinking Clearly. We should be the one that comes up. If you have a hard time finding it, you can go to thinkingclearly.libsyn.com. That's LIBSYN.com. And that is, you'll find our entire archive there, as well as a RSS link to add us to your podcast app. So that is how you can find Thinking Clearly.
And you already gave them a little clue about what the topic is tonight, and we're going to get right to it. So why don't you frame the topic for us, Julia?
Well, yeah. So this episode of Thinking Clearly is the second of a three-part series we're calling Seeking the Truth of the Matter. So you see what I did there?
You snuck in sneaking the truth.
So in part one last month, we discussed the present highly polluted state of our information environment and described a step-by-step method for vetting information in order to help us tentatively decide its truth value and to help decide what to do with the information we receive. And a summary sheet for that method is posted on our Facebook page. In this episode, we're taking a step back, and with the help of a guest, we will be exploring just a tiny topic, the nature of truth.
And that guest is Dave Seaford, pastor at the local First Baptist Church right here in Redway, California. And he's also a professor of apologetics, reason, and theology at Veritas Bible Institute. He has taught on the ethic of missions at the University of South Africa and taught theology at Sunbury Bible School in South Africa. Pastor Dave has a master's degree in apologetics from Southern Evangelical Seminary and a doctorate in practical theology from Trinity Evangelical Seminary. And he's been a speaker at Faith and Reason conferences in the U.S., in Russia, in South Africa, the Dominican Republic, and Mozambique. And with all this, Pastor Dave has still found time to be currently finishing up his first book, which is called Not So Common Sense, subtitle An Appeal to Facts Over Feelings. Pastor Dave Seaford, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Thank you, Bob and Julia. It's a pleasure to be with you guys.
Before we get started, Dave, I'm going to say a little bit about how we're going to tackle this major subject, the nature of truth. You know, we could go down a huge rabbit hole, maybe a series of rabbit holes, by tracking the philosophical twists and turns that map to what is truth. That would take about 15 episodes and require considerable extra credit for our listeners to keep tuned in. So we're going to take a different approach here. And that's going to be a structured civil dialogue between the three of us. Each one of us are going to be exploring our views on the nature of truth. And the way we're going to do this is that we've developed three foundational questions relating to the nature of truth, which we've all seen in advance, but we have not seen each other's answers at all. And each one of us is then going to take a turn answering the first question. And then after each person's answer, the other two We'll briefly reflect back just so that they have an understanding of the answer. We're not going to challenge. We're not going to ask a lot of other questions other than questions that might clarify what we've heard from the person, just so that we know we understand what the person has said. It's not going to be a debate. The focus is going to be on understanding each other's positions. And hopefully, listeners out there, we're going to ask them to think about what they think about the answers to these questions and the nature of truth. Then if there's time, at the end of the three rounds of questions, we can explore the areas of common ground and difference.
Yeah, so we want to remind listeners that around 7:45, 7:50, we will open the phone lines for you to join in with your questions and comments about this topic. We will announce when the phone lines open and give the number at that time.
Okay, so Pastor Dave, you got the format in your head there?
I think so, Bob.
Okay. Well, I'm going to ask the first question, and the order of answers are going to be, Dave, you're going to go first, and then Julia, and then me last for the first question, and then Julia will ask the second question, you'll ask the third question. So we'll do three rounds of this. And the first question is pretty simple. It goes like this. What do you mean by saying that a statement is true?
It sounds like a simple question, doesn't it?
It does.
It's interesting that 100 years ago, most of us would not have even thought to ask this question. Almost everyone understood that there are binaries, such as things that are definitely true and things that are clearly false. Today, we have legitimate scholars, mathematicians, and philosophers actually arguing formally over of whether 2 + 2 must always equal 4. With the advent of postmodernism in the 1960s and 70s, it seems to me, we tended to throw out the common sense in favor of sort of an academic Gnosticism, if you will. In 1946, 3 years before he published his first novel, 1984, George Orwell warned us that this would happen when he said, we would, and I quote, make lies sound like truth and replace truth with pure wind, unquote. Bertrand Russell, another philosopher and theologian, broke the primary views of truth down into three different perspectives, which I suspect that we'll cover tonight. The correspondence view of truth, which is truth is that which corresponds to reality. The coherent view, a group of facts that stick together or cohere together, allowing one to make truth claims. And the pragmatic view, which Russell summarily dismissed. And that pragmatic view was that if things work, if things actually function, that means that they are true. I hold the correspondence view of truth, which states again that truth is that which corresponds to reality. If we were to say how we got to such a truth, we could say that we tested these things through the coherent view or possibly even in the descriptive areas of truth through the pragmatic view. But those are only testing areas. I would say that the actual definition or the truth can be found in that which corresponds to reality.
So let me just ask a little bit, this is just to clarify your position. So say a little bit more about what are some of the things, can you give examples of some of what you mean by a true statement?
Let's start with some of the simple ones, like the mathematical proposition I issued earlier, 2 + 2 = 4, that is a given that most of us would accept as true. Because we've been exposed not only to the math, but to the reality of the physical world around us. But as we're going to get into a little later in the program, there are also other kinds of truth, things like moral truths or the fact of what is beautiful. And those can seem more gray in their areas, but they are areas in which some things that, particularly in the area of morality, which I'm particularly interested in, we can find things that we would agree, I believe, we'll test it anyway, are objectively and absolutely true.
That's the big question, and we'll get to that question next. Julia, do you want to restate any of what Pastor Dave has said, or do you think we pretty much understand?
I'm still absorbing it, but so I don't have any questions.
Okay. So let's go ahead. And Julia, how would you answer that question? What do you mean by saying that a statement is true?
Yeah, well, switching gears now, because I was just fully absorbing what Pastor Dave had to say. Mm-hmm. So to me, what really stands out is the question, saying a statement is true. We on this show have talked about quite a lot about constructing logical arguments. And so when I hear a statement is true, to me, that's speaking to the logical construction of a statement. You know, as we've discussed in previous shows, for a statement to be true, the premises must be known to be true and the reasoning must be valid, leading to a true conclusion. In the driest of ways, I would say that's what makes a statement true. On the other hand, I kind of rediscovered a love I have of Eric Fromm, who's a humanist psychologist of sorts. And he said something in a very similar way that I wanted to share. He said that a scientifically or rationally valid statement means that the power of reason is applied to all the available data of observation without any of them being suppressed or falsified for the sake of a desired result.
Do away with confirmation bias, huh?
I like that because it's a very eloquent statement that talks about the power of reason is applied to all available data of observation. So that's your, how do you know your premises are true? Usually you try and, well, it depends on what your premises are, but you try and verify it through observation, through data. And then you use the power of critical thinking, of logic, of reason to construct an argument that is valid, leading to a true conclusion.
Dave, would you feel comfortable in kind of restating what you heard Julia say?
Sure. And much of that I would agree with. I believe that if you're familiar with Richard Rorty, he was a philosophical deconstructionist. He argued that even language and the words, specific given words in language, did not have meaning until they had a relationship to the next word. He did a totally away in his arguments with any well-structured syllogism even. And so the idea of this whole postmodern relativistic words don't have meanings, if we get into the postmodern era of trying to make arguments from a deconstructionist viewpoint, we lose that syllogistic elegance. And I would tend to agree with you. I love going back to logic and reason and looking at things from that perspective. I just don't want to lose that. And so I think what Julia is arguing is absolutely right, in the sense that we can find truth in those structures of syllogisms. But in trying to define truth is what I was trying to do a little earlier. And so we're just looking at this from a different perspective, trying to find it rather than trying to describe it or define it.
I was hoping for more disagreement. It sounds like there's going to be a lot of agreement. So I'm going to give my answer, but I'm going to do it without any quotes or referring to any philosophers, all right?
He has to be a rebel.
I agree. There are factual, what I like to refer to as descriptive statements that can be well enough verified. And I when I was thinking about this, I kind of put them into categories of things that I would call factual statements of truth. Or they may be false, but they can be true or false, but we can evaluate their truth. And the first is an event that happened. So we know that President Kennedy was shot and killed on November 22nd, 1963. There's a lot of documentation about that, a lot of witnesses. There's a lot that has been written, and so most people would agree that that is true. Elvis might still be alive, but President Kennedy, we had a lot of witnesses to witness his death. So events that have happened that are well documented is one category that I would put in these descriptive truth statements. Another is just the things that are in the world out there. Like we can say there's a planetary body orbiting the sun at an average distance of 142 million miles. We agreed to call that Mars, and we invented the name for it and the category of calling it a planet, but it was there before there were any people to come up with those kinds of language-dependent ideas about Mars and that planet. So those are a couple that, in my mind, are pretty clear. Then additionally, we have some factual statements, and I call them conjectures or hypotheses or theories, that we can say have an ample or great amount of evidence supporting that they're true, and most everybody believes them. A couple are germ theory, for example, at the end of the 19th century is when that mainly was recognized and most people believed it. That is that tiny microscopic organisms are involved in certain human disease processes. And before that, somewhat before that, atomic theory that matter is composed of particles we call atoms. So most people believe those things. It's not just scientists. Those kinds of hypotheses or theories are well integrated as true factual statements. And then there are another group of theories that are pretty well accepted by scientists but have been politicized and are controversial among non-scientists. For example, the current one, theory anthropogenic, that's human-caused climate change. And for those theories, in order to evaluate those, they're more provisional. Those kinds of theories, especially when they're controversial and you have people that are even experts that might have some reservations about them. But I would go with whatever I can glean from the reading that I do and research that I am able to absorb and understand. And I would look to consensus of the experts for those and say, I will provisionally say that there's very probably true, those types of theories. So in this sense, I'm agreeing, I think, with both of you. I believe there's a real world out there and that we can attempt to accurately probe it using science and technology, critical thinking, and we can make statements about that world that have various probabilities of being true, depending on the amount of evidence, remembering always that scientific evidence and critical thinking theories and beliefs are always provisional and subject to revision if we have new evidence. Dave, does that sound like we're in pretty good agreement in this first question?
Yeah, I'm like you, Bob. I'm a little disappointed. I think that we're in agreement that there is historical evidence that we can turn to, and if there are a number of witnesses, eyewitnesses to events close to the period of time that the history was recorded, all of those kinds of things weigh into the quality and the reliability of that historical evidence. But we have plenty of that about a lot of those things that you mentioned, and others even deeper in history. Scientific truths, again, deconstructionists have tried to take apart scientific truths as well. And I'll try to touch on that in the period of time that we've got a little later to talk about the historical unpacking of the postmodern age.
Maybe we're going to find more disagreement in this second question. Let's tackle that. Julia's right. Going to ask the question. I'm going to go first, and then you will go second, Dave, and Julia will give her answer third. So go ahead and ask that question, Julia.
I'm rubbing my hands together because I feel like this is going to get juicy.
Okay.
All right. So the question is there a difference between descriptive truth about the tangible world versus value-based truth, moral, ethical, aesthetic truth, which is also called normative truth? So this is a question about, is there a difference between descriptive truth and a normative truth? Do I need to expand on that?
I'll take the first answer here, and I would say yes. Because as I talked about in the first question, I view truth as being based on evidence. It sounds like Julia does too. It sounds like Pastor Dave does too. And a logical connection between the evidence and a true conclusion. The method of using evidence to logically support or reject descriptive claims about what's in the world out there. And we might call that the scientific method or critical thinking. And that method is really pretty straightforward. We do experiments, we do observations, we develop hypotheses, we make predictions, we test those predictions, and then we reevaluate. So that's pretty clear, and to me is pretty straightforward. Whereas when we're talking about normative truth, which is values-based truth, that depends on which of the several methods that you use to justify the connection between your evidence and your conclusion. And it usually, and we've talked about this on the show before, requires introducing a should or an ought premise into any argument for it. Now, some of those methods, if I'm not going to get them all, but I'm just going to survey the methods, the first one I think of is intuition. That's what somebody asks us, well, do you think it's right or wrong to do this? And you go, boy, that's terrible. That's wrong. Everybody knows that's wrong. That's kind of that intuitive, quick response to the question. You're not looking at a bunch of evidence and arguments for it. It's intuitive. And that, I believe, is pre-wired. The basics of that intuitive moralism is pre-wired into us. They've done experiments with children. That seems to be true. And in my view, that developed evolutionarily and is pre-wired. We're social beings, and it's to our advantage to treat each other in certain ways that are going to facilitate cooperation. Other than intuition, then, you have a list of rules. Like the Ten Commandments, for example, you consult the rule books and see. That's your guide. Another way of doing it is a principle like the Golden Rule. Treat others as you'd like to be treated. So those are three of the ways. The other big one, probably my preferred first way of dealing with it, is to look at the consequences of the decision. Look at what happens if you do that behavior or if you make that law. Weigh those, the pros and cons. How do people benefit or suffer as a result of that behavior, the consequences? And so those are ways that we can kind of get into moral reasoning. So simply put, I believe there's a real material world out there that obeys the laws of physics, would exist if there were no human beings. But since there are human beings, you can best examine the process using science to descriptively probe that world. However, that's the descriptive world, the world out there. However, when you're talking about the other world that is values-based, the normative truths, the moral truths, the ethical truths, I think those are constructed by human beings, that there would be no morality if there weren't some kinds of life forms. Now, you might say plants have some morality because they try to help each other sometimes, ward off and communicate. Plants and actually trees and that can communicate. So I'm not going to just say human beings, but I'll say life, living beings. If there were no living beings, there would be no morality. However, I just want to say one thing, and I know I'm going on long here. I believe that we can use critical thinking, scientific-based, evidence-based procedures to come up with truths, and I'm optimistic about this, and find common ground with all other human beings and other species on the planet, and those can be a guide for our morality. So I don't look to a book, to a set of principles. I look to reasoning through what's going to benefit people in a consequentialist framework. That's my answer, and I'm sticking to it.
I'm still just here kind of absorbing it. I'm taking it in.
David's next, right?
Yeah. Dave, do you have any, well, first of all, do you have any feedback, or do you want to repeat back, or questions for Bob and what his statement was?
Yeah, I think that we're probably close in the descriptive truth area. I would slightly challenge the way we frame the question, and this is where we're going to get into a bit of more of a discussion, I'm sure, in that when we refer to the descriptive truth as the real world, I mean, even people like Sam Harris agree that normative truths, or what I would describe as a Christian as prescriptive truths, are fact-based and absolute in their nature and very real. So I would change that slightly to say that talk about the material world versus maybe immaterial things like morals. But I think in terms of the descriptive area, we're very close. I would be interested in probably more discussion than we've got time for this evening, but to talk a little more about how that evolutionary process would have taken place in the normative truth area in sort of a winner-take-all evolutionary process. And like I say, I think that's going to be a longer discussion than we've got time for tonight, but I think it's an interesting question anyway to sort of plant as a seed.
I'm getting that we agree on what we've called the real world out there, these descriptive things that would be there if human beings weren't around. But these values-based truths, are you saying that they are not any different than the descriptive truths? I'm not quite sure.
I would say that in terms of whether they are actually true, I would say that they are the same in the sense that they both have truth value. In answering the questions whether truths can be established in things like morals, we have to establish whether morals are fixed or flexible. Whether we hold that morals are nothing more than cultural mores that change with the temperature of the culture, or if they are absolute rights and there are absolute wrongs, in order to do this, we probably need to run to the extremes and ask questions that, as I think it was Julia earlier said, that seem like the things we could agree on, the extreme things. Is it ever right? Is it ever moral to torture infants for fun? And I think that just about anybody in any culture at any time would agree that it's absolutely wrong that would happen. And so we would have to say there is at least one absolute truth claim we could make in regards to normative or moral truths. So whereas we would maybe not have disagreement over very factual issues and descriptive areas, we would think we might have a conflict in the normative areas, but in those extremes, we probably don't.
Mm-hmm. It's up to you now, Julia, to see where you're at, and maybe you can bring some closure to those two slight shades of difference between Pastor Dave and I, which I think are probably, if we got into specifics, would become more defined.
Yeah, I have to admit, this of the three questions, this one was a little, I don't know, I had a hard time really pinpointing my own position. What I can say is, first of all, descriptive truth is a claim that such and such is the case. It's not the same as objective or absolute truth. So just want to get that out of the way. Descriptive truth is, in essence, our perception of reality, of what is the big R reality. I can say that as an example, I can say, you know, the descriptive truth of this bottle is it's blue and it's white and it's silver. But the reality might be that I don't see the color green and therefore don't see the color green on it. We know that as humans, our eyesight is limited. I don't see infrared. I don't see ultraviolet. Therefore, I cannot include that in my descriptive truth, even though it may in fact be there. So that's how I would kind of neatly sum up descriptive truth. I feel like that was the easy one. The difference, normative truth, you know, this is where I really would come back to say that, you know, we are social animals and our morality is largely, it's a couple things. It's a cultural consensus of what our moral framework is. And
it's cultural consensus. Does that mean that if a particular culture thinks it's okay, you know, female genital mutilation is okay, that consents among that culture that practice is moral?
Well, no, that's not what I said. It might be their normative truth. It might be that, again, so a moral ethical framework, you know, is that in our society, in our culture, we agree cats are good, dog are bad. You know, that doesn't actually speak to any sort of inherent good or bad of the dog or cat. It's a consensus that we have in our society that this means that and this means that. I would say so to go. I'm not a total postmodernist. I just put that out there. I do think that our underlying moral framework is based on survival. It's to accomplish success of our species. And so in that sense, I think, you know, that's where we're, again, a social animal. We're collectivist in a lot of ways. So, you know, I would never say that it's like okay to murder someone because you feel like it. That doesn't serve the underlying survival of our species. Even though we may not be thinking specifically like that, but to me, that's like the lowest, most core foundation of what the moral framework is built on. So from there, you can say, okay, for our species to be successful, women have to cook and men have to hunt. And that becomes the normative truth of that group. But it can, much like our, as we talked about in our first question, statements of truth, as we gain more information, as we change our collective consensus, that statement of truth can and will change. So it's in no way static.
There's a lot there, and we're going to. I'm hoping that we'll have a little bit of time at the end to isolate our common ground and our differences. But why don't we go to the third question? Because we're touching on it anyway in our answers. So Dave, go ahead and read that question, and Julie will answer first. I'll answer second. And you'll answer last.
Do hope we can get back to the cultural consensus area. I think that's a very interesting conversation.
Definitely.
What are your thoughts about absolute truth versus relative truth? Does it make sense for someone to say this is my truth or that's only your truth? There seems to me we're hearing a lot of that today.
Yeah. So this is in philosophy class, I feel like where we started. And I love the fact that this is really more towards the end of our conversation. Absolute versus relative truth. Absolute truth, in my mind, is something that exists out there. And we're constantly trying to get a little bit more insight into it. We're trying to find new ways to observe it, to measure it, and to update our understanding of what it is. But we exist in absolute truth, in that we, that's kind of a weird statement to make, but surprised myself. But that we're inside of it. We're like fish in a fishbowl. And for us to totally comprehend the entirety of absolute truth, we would have to somehow not be a fish. And this, that's not going to happen, it's to the best of my knowledge. Relative truth, I experimented with relativism when I was young. I'll admit it. There, I said it.
Did you inhale?
But, you know, what I've come to realize is relative truth is very real. I would call it experiential truth. When you have a dream that you jumped off a building and you had that sensation and your heart was pumping, and then usually what happens to me is I hit the ground and then I float a little and then I wake up. And that experience is in my body. You can't tell me that it's not. I had the experience of jumping off a building, of landing on the ground, and of surviving it. But it was a dream in my brain. So to me, that's a relative truth. They're, again, I would say experiential. But I got to throw one more thing in there. My buddy, Eric Fromm, he had something that he called optimal truth. And so I'm just going to throw that out there real quick. He said that absolute truth is sterile and that it emphasizes its emphasis ought to be placed on optimal truth. He considered truth as stemming from, and I mentioned this earlier, the survival imperative of grasping at one's environment physically and intellectually, whereby young children instinctively seek truth so as to orient themselves in a strange and powerful world?
Well, there's so much here that I can see that it's going to take at least three shows to do this justice. So let's move on to that last question, and Pastor Dave is going to ask that question.
It's your answer now.
I guess
he asked the question.
All right, I see. I was getting carried away. My answer is going to be uncharacteristically short for this. I've already said that for descriptive truths involving only statements about things that are in the world out there, that the answer is no. It makes no sense to say this is my truth. You don't get to decide what's out there in the real world. All right. You may have a subjective experience of falling in a dream, but that's a subjective experience. And if it wasn't witnessed by other people, I would not say it really happened in the world. So it wouldn't be an event, even though you experienced it subjectively, that I would say is a true event. It was true for you in that you experienced it, but it didn't truly happen in the world. So you don't get to decide what's true out there in the real world. I'm not much of a postmodernist at all, or relativist when it comes to truth. I'm a constructionist when it comes to the normative questions, though, the moral ethical questions. I'm not a realist when it comes to moral truths. I don't think that there are truths written in the real world. It's up to us humans to devise the best system for answering those questions. And I do believe that our culture gives us some extra apps that we can run on our inborn, pre-wired, evolutionarily developed information processor, you know, to take us beyond our prehistoric frames and allow us to construct broad and beneficial ideas and practices for us and our planet and eventually our universe. And I think that is the project for humanity to solve. And I think we're in the midst of doing that. We're in some rough edges right now towards doing that. But that's my answer.
Okay. Well, you jump back into moral truths. Let me do that as well before I get into really digging too deeply into absolutes and relatives. Of course, as a person that looks at moral truth as being fixed, and if there is at least one absolute moral truth, then the apologetic argument from a Christian standpoint is there must be a moral lawgiver. That if we all have this, as the Bible says in Romans, written on the hearts of men, that we have that instinctive gut reaction to certain things, that things like we've already discussed, then there's something universal about that. And so we have to ask ourselves, where did that come from? And is it reasonable and logical to think through an evolutionary process that would produce that? But again, that's a very long discussion, and we probably don't have time for that. But let me get into the question of absolutes and relatives. And I would agree with you, Bob, about these people that are talking about my truth or your truth. They're talking more about their experience. They're coming from a standpoint of their opinion or their perspective. But truth regarding particular things doesn't change. If the room is 80 degrees and one person's cold, another person's comfortable, another person's hot, the room's still 80 degrees. They're having different experiences with the same set of circumstances. If words have meaning, and the phrase absolute truth as it was presented or thought about 100 years ago would have been a redundancy. Truth by its definition would have been truth. To say absolute in front of that is just to repeat what you're saying. And I think that the phrase relative truth is really, if you think about just the meaning of the words, is almost a contradiction in terms. And to steal a phrase from my own blogs, I'll shamelessly plug my blog, truth is truth. So we were going to do a bullet point history, Bob, and I don't know if we got time for that or not. If we do, it'd probably take about 3 minutes to run through. I think it might be helpful, but I'm going to leave that to your time.
I think what might help, how we might best use the time that we have, which is limited now, but I think it would be more helpful to see if we can identify some of the common ground and some of the differences. Because the other thing we're doing, besides just talking about our visions of what the nature of truth is, we are actually demonstrating a sort of civil dialogue. I like to call it intellectual empathy, where we're listening to each other and not trying to argue with each other, not trying to form a counter argument, not trying to find questions that are going to cause that person to get on the defensive. We're trying to understand. Mm-hmm. And so I think the final kind of closure of that process is to identify areas that we have found a common agreement about and areas that we may have some differences in. So I'm going to throw that back to either Julia or you, Dave, to see if you can kind of summarize a little bit. What do you think we have in common from what we've talked about on about the nature of truth?
Well, being the gentleman I am, ladies first.
You ready to go?
Yeah, I spend so much time just listening to you guys one by one. I think the thing that really stands out to me is we all squarely believe in an absolute reality that is true, that is observable, measurable, and informs and should inform how we navigate through this world.
Yeah, I think that too. And that we are all look for evidence in supporting what those truths are. Would you agree with that, Dave?
Absolutely. I think we're in total agreement there, and rightly so.
Okay, so we are
none of us genuinely postmodernist.
No, and we don't believe that we live in the Matrix. So it's probably the significant areas of difference lie in the normative truth, the value-based truth, the moral, ethical truths. And it seems like both Julia and I are looking towards evolutionarily developed that came from evolution, because we live as social creatures, so we have to learn to cooperate. And that was kind of the nexus, the seed for morality, and that now we have all kinds of reasoning that we can get into consequentialism or whatever to as an adjunct to those intuitive wired in truths.
Yeah.
But Dave, it sounds like you are more of the persuasion that there is a sort of absolute revealed truth. Now, am I?
Well, he said a fixed moral truth. Is that, I know it says a difference.
I would say that like both of you have hinted at here, we live in a world where we don't see all of those things, and we don't comprehend all of those things, whether you're talking about physical things or moral things. We don't totally get our arms around those things. But I would say that with regard to Julia, your conversation concerning cultural consensus, I would throw that more into the area of mores. Those are socially created mores. That have been adapted for culture and society that help us through the day-to-day. Many of those are taken from genuine morals that are, I would argue, are written upon the hearts of men, that we have this genuine understanding that certain things are right and certain things are wrong. And we describe those in the laws we write, in the rules that we make for our living, our lives, and our homes every day, the rules we have even down to our governmental agencies and businesses and so forth. But in terms of genuine, strong morals, there's a fixed moral law that I believe demands a moral lawgiver. And I don't believe in any way, shape, or form that it is something that could develop out of a genuinely Darwinian kind of evolutionary process where only the strong survive. So, like I say, those are interesting conversations, and certainly both positions have credits and weaknesses to them.
It sounds like we have some common ground, and we agree with that. And I think we've isolated some of the differences in terms of normative or moral issues.
Yeah, and we have one caller on hold who, I mean, apparently was very eager and got on early.
Oh, okay. So we do have a caller.
We do have a caller.
All right. So let's connect that caller. Caller, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Going to call back.
Oh, okay.
He's
going
to call back.
I mean, they called really early on. We do. Right. We love hearing from our callers, but it's even better if we open the phone lines first. So,
yeah. So Dennis or Julia, let us know when we have a caller, and we'll just go ahead and continue with our discussion, because we have only gotten the very, very tippy top of
like
the iceberg.
I feel like we pretty much figured this out.
You think so?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is we've got this.
We've solved this problem.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we got 7 more minutes. We could, you know. Does God exist? We could totally tackle that.
Yeah. So you made it clear, Pastor Dave, that one of the areas of difference that it sounds like you have from Julia and I is that whereas Julia and I believe that evolution can account for at least the germ for moral thinking and moral behavior. And do we have a call?
We do have a caller now.
Oh, okay. Well, let's take the caller and maybe we can get back to that. Okay, caller, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Totally appreciate the conversation towards the evolutionary idealism of us coming together for what is like really important in life. And I believe I heard you say instinct earlier, and I love that. It's like, go with your instinct. And that every society and culture has its own ways. And humans have been many things for many times, even before we were humans, going back long times ago. And all the other animals have their own way of seeing things. But having been in search of truth myself, I only found there to be 4 truths.
Okay.
I believe in consciousness, eternalness, limitless, and love. That we're all conscious, therefore we're alive, and we can communicate. Eternal, that we either there's nothing or here, but we're here, so therefore, God believe maybe we'll come back from nothing. Limitless, and if anything that we can imagine is in out of the miraculous of the universe we know, anything's possible. And it's out of love, so love. So conscious, eternal, limitless, and love. And those 4 things guide me on the way towards truth,
mm-hmm.
Whereas first, it steps out of the side of the way people believe or the boundaries of civilization or the mores or any religion.
And what influenced your development of that thinking? Was it someone that inspired those thoughts?
Yeah. My aunt, when I was young, was throwing up in the bathroom when I was 12. I'm 56. So she was talking about religion to my mother, and she hung herself. And then my mother disappeared for 5 years and came back and said she saw God. And so it made me have to seek, like, what's the reality of God? And I was raised atheist, so these are the truths I just learned is all of it. If I had to write a book about religion, it would just say conscious, eternal, limitless, and love. And it's all the answers. It, like, people can't limit, we can do anything, and it's us that make it happen.
Yeah, it sounds like quite a life journey. Would you say that these 4 truths, which resonate with me, inform your moral framework?
Completely. If anything goes against it, then I disagree with it. That nothing should control anything to not allow for a limitless love or, you know, consciousness. Or
Dave, do you have any comments about caller's 4 truths?
Yeah, I'm having a little bit of a difficult time hearing. It's a little muddled on my end, and I apologize if I don't understand exactly. But I think that the caller may actually benefit by a message I brought this past Sunday on the interlinking and inextricable connection between truth and love. And it actually is posted online now if somebody wants to go listen to it. But there's a linkage between truth and love
that
cannot be separated.
The truth that I learned between conscious, eternal, and limitless, love being number 4, love was the hardest one to believe in. And that's the vibration that you feel when something like angelic proceeds around you, like the Holy Spirit. That's love. And so there's the truth in love is in itself. And love, who's going to define love? You know, all of eternity or us as humans? So,
Dave, you were starting to talk about the connection between love and in this blog that you wrote.
The message I brought this past Sunday is posted on YouTube and on our Facebook page, and the whole message is rooted in 3 John, which is talking about the inseparability of truth and love. If you have love without truth, you may have a mushy, warm feeling, but there's no substance to it. And if you have truth without love, it can be arrogant and it can be in your face. And so both of those together, they demand each other. They require each other. And so I just think the caller might enjoy listening to that. And if he has some conversation beyond that he would like to have, I would love to have that as an ongoing conversation.
How would you get engaged in an ongoing conversation? Can people make comments on your blog?
Yes, they can. And, of course, through our webpage at the church, fbcredway.com. My blog is truthistruth.blogspot.com. Our Facebook page, if you just look up David Seaford on Facebook, you'll find me here in Redway. Or on YouTube, if you just look up First Baptist Church Redway, there's a whole series of messages. And the very last one, or the very first one in this case listed there, would be the message I'm referring to.
Let's just kind of wrap this up a little bit. Do you have any other contacts or information that you'd like to get out to the listeners? Pastor okay, Dave, yeah, and thank you, caller, for your call.
Yeah, just once again, the Facebook, First Baptist Church Redway, or my personal Facebook page is just David Seaford, S-E-A-F-O-R-D. You can look up on YouTube, First Baptist Church Redway, and you'll see a whole series of messages there. And then my blog is truthistruth.blogspot.com. And we can engage in conversations there. My email address, which is the easiest way to get up with me, is D, as in David, _ Seaford, S-E-A-F-O-R-D, at MSN.com.
Okay, well, I hope that spurs some listeners to engage you in conversations. And I wish we could engage you a little bit longer. If we had another 3 hours, we could do justice maybe to touching on the ins and outs of this topic. But Pastor Dave Seaford, we want to thank you very much for sharing your perspectives on the nature of truth with us on this episode of Thinking Clearly. And thank you to our listeners.
Thank you, Bob. And listen, Bob and Julia both, the opportunity for civil discourse on things like this is so needed in our country right now. And I hope this really sets an example for how people who don't totally agree on issues can have civil discussion and profit by it.
Well said.
Yeah, absolutely. I look forward to doing this some more.
And thank you very much. And thanks, Dennis, our engineer. And as always, Julia, until next time, keep thinking
clearly.
This program was produced in KMUD's Redway Studio and is provided courtesy of KMUD, Redwood Community Radio.